So this topic is very useful, given I just shared that new essential skills list. One of the elements of the essential skills list is that our mentees, that all of us, have a really informative, non-intimidating way of introducing neurofeedback to new clients. So excellent topic. Thank you, Shelley.
Okay, so obviously when we're presenting neurofeedback to new clients, it's all going to depend a little bit on firstly the type of client population that we're actually seeing, as well as obviously what type of neurofeedback we're doing. So I'm doing amplitude training, but I'm going to try and make it a little bit more generic for us all, so that you know, it's just basically the principles of what we need to present. Now, I'll start by saying that I am a clinical neuropsychologist, and I realise that I am a lone warrior in Australia in regards to this. So I probably do present it slightly differently, coming from a bit more of a neuropsych perspective. But again, I'll just be trying to present the broad overview of this. So there's five different things that I really try and get across when I'm presenting neurofeedback to people for the first time, and I'll go through each of those things with you guys today. The first one is the model, which is really the context in which I present neurofeedback and where it fits in with other different types of therapies that I offer. Also the theory behind it, which I always find is a little bit tricky depending upon what the clinical presentation is and who I'm actually presenting this to, because obviously there's a lot we don't know about the theory, so I try and keep it quite simple. Then, of course, there's the practical side of it, what it involves. There's the commitment in terms of explaining what they're up for if they start neurofeedback training. And then, of course, there's expectations of how we monitor it, what we're going to see, and you know, what we're going to expect. So I'll start off with the model. Now, I'm a huge believer in presenting models to patients. I've got up here the CBT model, which most of you are probably going to be familiar with. So situations, creating thoughts, creating emotions, creating behaviours. And I've taken a slight adaptation of the CBT model, which I present in relation to neurofeedback. So obviously, being a neuropsych, I think there's something in between situations and thoughts, and that is actually cognitive skills. So that we know that when we experience certain things in our life, they don't just create thoughts. It actually has got to go through our memory systems, our attention systems. We know this from the ACT model, which talks a lot about language and about mindfulness, that it has to go through these cognitive skills, and then you've got the thoughts, the emotions, and behaviours. So the next adaptation I've made is sort of the concept of brain functioning. So obviously, cognitive skills are highly reliant upon how our brain is processing information and how it's functioning, whether it's working at optimal levels. So I've really got this sort of filter down effect that you've got brain functioning, which then affects cognitive skills, which then affects thoughts and emotions, which then affects behaviours. And this is the model that I present to patients. I'm going to go through this backwards with you guys today, but usually I would start explaining it in terms of brain functioning. So a lot of the patients that I see obviously have cognitive deficits. They might have TBI or epilepsy, or they might have just standard ADHD or learning disabilities. But they are quite complex, the patients that I see, and they do need often therapy at multiple levels. So in terms of starting at the tail end of this, in terms of behaviours, I'll be talking about, if there are behavioural issues, different forms of behaviour therapy. So obviously in terms of kids, I might be talking about parenting, I might be talking about reward systems, you know, we might be talking about an ACT therapy if it's for kids or even for adults. And I'll talk a little bit about how we modify behaviours and different types of therapy that might be worthwhile trialling. Then in terms of thoughts and emotions, obviously we have cognitive-based therapies, CBT. And that also might be worthwhile trialing. Then we've got, in terms of cognitive skills, some form of cognitive training. Now, this doesn't just involve things like attention, memory, executive functioning, which are obviously really important for people who've got ADHD, but it also might involve other cognitive processes like language skills. They might be seeing a speech therapist in my centre, or even high-level visual training if they have, say, a neglect, or if they have high-level, you know, visual spatial deficits. They might be seeing an orthoptist and having those trained too. Then at the top end, obviously, you've got brain functioning and you need some form of brain-based treatment. So when I present this to a patient, I usually start with the top end and I explain the flow down effect, that if you can treat at the level of brain functioning, then you're going to naturally, hopefully, be able to improve cognitive skills. If you can improve cognitive skills, then that really does help with things like the emotional side of things, which then helps with the behavioral side. So what I try and inspire patients to really think about is not just coming in and doing a behavioral management for ADHD, or just coming in and doing, say, some CBT or even cognitive training, but actually trying to get to the root base of the issues and then hope that that will treat the majority of things we're looking at. But if it's not treating everything, then doing supplementary training in whatever additional areas. And for some people, it might be they need training at all, you know, at every single level. But for a lot of our patients that we actually treat, we often find even neurofeedback alone can actually address a lot of the emotional and behavioral issues. And we do cognitive full neuropsychological assessments before and after neurofeedback, and often you see massive improvements in cognitive ability without actually having to do any cognitive skill training at all. I think speech therapy is one area where we can see improvements, but I often still recommend it, and same with visual training. But generally the concept is to really get across the fact that if you can treat at the brain-based level, you're really going to have this beautiful filter on effect that you only have to then deal with residual issues. So in terms of brain-based treatments, what do we have available? Now, we're all going to be offering different sorts of things, but these are the five main ones, I guess, that people are probably using. There might be things like AVE as well. I personally don't do neurostimulation, but I sort of look at this in terms of when I go through the options, what are the ones which you should do in the sort of preferred order. So sleep is one of the biggest ones. I think if you're going to be talking about neurofeedback with people, you need to be looking at their sleep and potentially starting with sleep before you even touch upon neurofeedback, because if someone has really poor sleep hygiene, or, you know, doesn't have their blue light filters on and, you know, can't get to sleep, or is very, very anxious, then obviously that's going to have, you know, limit to some extent the benefits of neurofeedback. However, we all know that neurofeedback can have wonderful improvements in sleep. But if it's just poor sleep hygiene, then, you know, we need to sort of start treating at that level. The next level is diet. I do talk about, you know, always with people, if I can, some level of just getting the best brain fuel in as possible, avoiding toxins, chemicals, you know, reducing sugar as much as possible. Obviously, you need to speak about alcohol use, coffee use, drug use before you're talking about neurofeedback. But if you can start to, you know, play around with some of these things, then you're going to see improvements before you even get to the neurofeedback level. And obviously, if diet's really bad, again, it's going to limit the ability of neurofeedback to do what it's meant to be doing. But I do find diet is one of the very hardest things that I can convince, particularly parents, to be able to change. So that's definitely something I want to introduce a little bit more in my practice over the next year, but I do find parents are very resistant to that. But I do talk a lot about myelinogenesis and neurogenesis and synaptogenesis, and how diet is going to play, you know, some sort of important role in that. And we don't really understand that, but I might talk again about supplementation, things like fish oils and ginkgo and things like that, and try and get them to at least start thinking about diet and fueling their brain properly. The next one I obviously talk about is neurofeedback, and that's the one I obviously explain the most. I will always mention medication, and I will always discuss the difference between neurofeedback and medication. And the way that I usually describe it is that medication is more of a temporary fix, and this is more in relation to, I guess, stimulant medication or even things like antidepressant or anxiolytics, that it will change the brain while you are taking them, but when they're removed, obviously the brain will go back to its previous brain state. You know, I talk about why I like neurofeedback in terms of having more long-term changes. I'll talk about operant conditioning, obviously, at this stage, and that usually goes over most people's heads. But they do get the concept of neuroplasticity, and they do get the concept that the brain is learning. We're not forcing the brain into any sort of brain firing pattern. The brain is learning and doing it themselves. And I think patients tend to really like the concept of the autonomy, that they're learning something, and that they're in control, opposed to medication and neurostimulation, where it's more passive. And I've included neurostimulation here because often patients will say, oh, are you putting electricity through the brain? And I'll explain to them, no, neurofeedback, we're not. But that is a possibility, and it's not something that I personally offer, but obviously if you do offer it, you're going to have different thoughts about the ordering of this. I know a lot of the people who do neurostimulation will do it before neurofeedback or at the beginning of neurofeedback, and obviously these models are going to be adapted according to the patients that you're seeing, the types of treatment that you offer. But I generally present these five different brain-based treatments and then go into neurofeedback, basically saying that neurofeedback, other than sleep and diet, which obviously do need to be addressed at some level, neurofeedback is the one main thing that we offer at my clinic. So then I go into the theory side of it. And this is when I think I really try and inspire patients in terms of going through the different brainwaves. Now, this brainwave table was taken from pretty much from one of Moshe's slides that he gave when I did my training with him. It's slightly adapted, and the truth is that I don't even know if this is correct. I don't know, for example, what too little SMR or too much SMR looks like, but the main concept that I like to take people through is the concept of we do have different brain waves. I explain, you know, the slow wave, the delta, sleep wave, theta, you know, the dreamy state, and I go through all these different states, and I explain it into relation to whatever disorder we're looking at. And the main thing that I do is obviously if we're looking at, say, a sleep disorder or, you know, people who are too sleepy or people who can't fall asleep, I might be talking about what we might expect in terms of, say, beta levels or delta levels or alpha levels. And I get them to start thinking, whether it's themselves or whether it's for their child, about what their brain might be looking like. And I find this actually really excites patients that they might go, oh, you know, my child, it sounds like they've got way too much beta, their mind's always going, they can't relax, they can't fall asleep. And it gets them to start to think, okay, there is this thing called brainwaves and there's a certain type of regulation that we expect to see. And it sounds like my child's brain or my own brainwaves might be out. And it gets them to start thinking that, okay, if we can understand the different brainwaves, then we can understand what it is that we need to try and change and adapt. And at this stage, I also present an arousal model picture. Sorry, I actually don't have it as part of my slides. For some reason, I couldn't get it onto the PowerPoint. But basically, it goes through sleep under and over arousal. It goes through attention under and over arousal, mood and behavior. And again, I get them to really start to classify whether it's for themselves or a child. Are they more under-aroused? Are they more over-aroused? Are they a combination of the two? And the main thing is to really have them see the big picture, that whether they come in for ADHD or they come in for sleep disorder or whatever it is they're coming in for, often they have multiple issues at multiple levels. So someone will come in with ADHD and they won't be able to fall asleep and they'll be hyperactive. And they'll be quite anxious and they'll fit in, say, that over-aroused. And I often talk about DSM-5 diagnoses and how misleading they can be, because just because someone's diagnosed with ADHD and, say, recommended to go on a stimulant medication, it's not going to hit all the areas that it needs to hit. So, for example, if someone is over-aroused and they go on an ADHD medication, but that child can't fall asleep or the adult can't fall asleep, it's often going to make sleep worse. So it gets them very excited at the concept that we can really pinpoint regions of the brain, say if someone's got both fast wave and slow wave, and we can start to train very specific regions according to their particular brain profile. So it's not really about sort of taking a medication and just hitting the entire brain and hoping that it's going to get the areas that need to be hit, but rather we can really pinpoint and fine-tune different sort of brain profiles. So I'll sort of show them some brain maps at this point, and I'll say, you know, let's get excited. It sounds like you might have this, you might have that. It sounds like it might be in this region. You know, if you want to sort of look at this type of therapy, it's great to get a brain map. It's great to really understand what's happening in your brain or your child's brain. And then we can really pinpoint some therapies and really understand what's going on. And I find that patients really love the concept of a brain map. They love the concept of a picture. I mean, I know brain maps don't tell us everything, but I think patients really understand the concept of, I have different sorts of brain waves and I can have low in some areas and I can have high in some areas. And we have this ability to really fine tune and target different regions of the brain, that if you've got a lot of slow wave, you know, and you're sluggish and you've got a lot of executive issues, you can start to activate through those regions. If you've got a lot of fast waves sitting over, you know, the, you know, right hemisphere and you've got a really explosive child, you can really take down a lot of that fast wave and calm the kid. And it just makes them very excited that you've got this very objective real-time measure of brain functioning, which, you know, a lot of people who come to me, say, with an ADHD diagnosis, if we're not diagnosing it ourselves, they haven't even got objective measures. They've just got subjective ratings. Obviously, we do full neuropsychological assessment and full attention testing, but a lot of people get very disillusioned when they come and say, well, this is what I was offered and this medication is not working. And I'll start to be able to talk about objective data, whether that's neuropsych data or whether that's brain mapping or a combination of both, which obviously is what we do. That we can then monitor the actual efficacy of any treatment by using, you know, real objective data, not just subjective ratings. So I'll go at this stage into how neurofeedback works. I might take them down to one of our neurofeedback rooms. I'll show them the setup. I'll go through the concepts again of operant conditioning. I'll show them how the sensors work, the ear clips. If someone's autistic spectrum, obviously I'll be asking straight away about any sensory issues because I don't want to get someone excited about neurofeedback and find out that they can't have anyone touch their head. You know, I'll be sort of showing them maybe some of the brainwaves on a screen and explaining how we inhibit certain brainwaves and we can act, you know, increase or activate certain other brainwaves. I show them how that works. It's a very hard thing, I think, for patients to really understand because they're always saying to me, you know, what is it? What does my child have to think? And it's probably around this time that I explain to them the CAT study. So I'll say to them, look, you know, the research in neurofeedback's been around for 50 years or so, and I'll explain to them the original studies done on cats and implanting the electrodes. I'm sure you all know the research. And I'll say, look, you know, the cats were able to produce more SMR and they became very placid. And obviously cats are not thinking. And I give that example so that they really understand that we're not thinking of anything. A cat can train in this and the brain will figure out how to get the reward. So I'll go through the basics in terms of how the neurofeedback works. And then I'll go through the practical. And I really think the practical side of it, you know, is really important in terms of understanding, you know, that they're going to need to have some form of QEG. Now, it might be, you know, we have someone who's autistic spectrum and they're not going to put a cap on, or we might have a four-year-old who can't sit 2 seconds. So it might be that we're just putting a single sensor or, you know, maybe doing a mini map of 5 sensors, whatever that person particularly needs. And I explain to them the difference between and the information you can get out of it. Then I'll go through the formal assessment. For some patients, when I go through neurofeedback, I'll mainly do it if someone already comes in with a diagnosis, but often when they come in with a diagnosis, they actually haven't had formal assessment in terms of attention skills or working memory or processing speed or any of those cognitive skills. So they often, even if they have had an assessment for, will have to undergo that form of baseline assessment. If they haven't had standardized questionnaires done, we'll obviously do that. Or if they have had them done and it hasn't been in the last month, I'll get more questionnaires done so that we've got that really good, strong baseline, which we can then formulate the efficacy of the treatment. I'll go through the practical side in terms of how many sessions needed and for how many weeks. I find that a little bit difficult sometimes. Obviously, we know for ADHD, you know, average 40 sessions. But there are other disorders that we see, and I don't necessarily have an answer for that. So I'll often say to them, look, let's look at your QEG. Let's see how dysregulated the brain is. If it only looks mild, maybe it'll be shorter. You know, if it's very severe issues, maybe it'll be longer. And obviously with comorbidities, I don't want to be talking about, you know, for a kid who's got seizures and autism and anxiety and ADHD. I don't necessarily want to be talking about number of weeks. It's more about, you know, giving them an idea about how long it's going to take to see changes and then stabilizing those changes and having them understand the practical side to how many sessions they might be committing to. There's obviously the time off, school and work, that needs to be taken into account. We always get feedback within around 24 hours if they've been training a while. It might be longer. They have to commit to sending that feedback in because obviously we need to set protocols, and if they're not getting their feedback in, then we can't set protocols, and only some of my staff can set protocols because we do have neurotechnicians working for us. you can't, so they need to really commit to being able to get that feedback in, which is all online. And then there's also the follow-up assessment. So I'll go through in terms of if they have had an assessment with us, what it is we're actually going to follow up on in terms of what tests we're going to be repeating, when we're going to be repeating those tests, whether they're formal neuropsychological measures or whether they're just questionnaires and emotional ratings, things like that. Then, then we have the commitment. Now, the commitment is something which I really find I need to hammer home to a lot of patients, especially the ones who are adults with ADHD. They really need to understand they are going to be, you know, missing out on significant amounts of work or school. They need to consider whether or not they're going away. You don't want to start training and then they're going away for 6 weeks at some point. They really need to start neurofeedback at the correct time in their lives. In terms of costs, I think in the beginning, we did have a few patients who started and then stopped because of the cost. And we did go through all the costs with them up front, but now we really do hammer home that they really need to take this into consideration because they can't just do 15 sessions and then stop and then expect the results to be stabilised. So they need to make that commitment and possibly delay until they can actually afford neurofeedback. It's just a consideration that, you know, you don't want someone to be getting wonderful effects and then they have to stop and all the results backslide. Feedback, we hammer home that feedback needs to be on time. Obviously, working with people with ADHD, it's very, very difficult. They forget to give their feedback. They show up. They haven't got a protocol set. It's exhausting. So that needs to really be hammered home, that level of commitment that they need to be setting up reminders on their phones to be sending us the feedback. Then lastly, expectations. And this is probably... this is the final area that I go through and it's probably one of the most important. So in terms of side effects, and this all comes in as well under really good informed consent. So side effects, obviously, if you're doing a relaxation protocol, you might under-arouse someone. If they're adults, they might be in a car. You don't want them to be having accidents. You know, you might have a kid who's going to school. You might be under-arousing them. They might have a test that day. They need to understand that right at the beginning of training, especially the first session or whenever you do a major protocol change, that there might be significant side effects. And obviously, we don't train side effects. Obviously, we change the protocols. We'll make the training higher or lower or change the region or change the amount of time that we're training. And we do try to get patients on some level involved in that, and we do tell them about the protocols we're doing and the levels that we're training so they can make an informed decision, especially if it's actually even with adults, but especially for kids that, you know, parents will know their kids the best. They will understand, those minute changes and what protocols are going to have the best results. So we'll go through, you know, what it might look like if we under-arouse them and to really be... on the lookout for symptoms of under-arousal or over-arousal, obviously, to be on the lookout for that. You know, sometimes we'll have teams who come in and we'll only hear 4 weeks later because the team hasn't told the parents that they can't, you know, they haven't been sleeping that well. So it's about really having patients understand that even though a kid might or themselves might not have a sleep issue, we might be doing some activation training and it might be that we start to affect sleep. So they need to give us feedback, and our forms, our online forms, do have 4 different sections, I believe. It goes through changes in sleep, changes in attention, changes in mood and changes in behaviour. I think there's another section for people who come in with tic disorders as well. They need to not only let us know about their symptoms that they have, but also about symptoms that might be new, which they didn't have previously. So obviously in informed consent, it's important to go through that, you know, if you are, if there is something important coming up in their life, you know, if they're going away on holiday, you don't want to over-arouse them. You know, if they've got like an important exam the next day, you don't want to be playing around with too much relaxation training or going too low. And if someone's driving, and that's the one which always concerns me the most, making sure that they take the time after the session to make sure they're okay to drive. And if they are getting sleepy, making sure that they're sort of walking that off and not just jumping straight into a car. The next expectation down is how to know when it's working. So things to watch and how to monitor. So one of the things that we have, and we have a little bit of an information pack that we give to parents prior, is how they should journal certain behaviours that they see. So for example, you might have a child with ADHD who's very hyperactive and they have problems, say, sitting down at the dinner table or problems sitting down to do homework. And what we'll get the parent to do is to write a little bit of a journal for themselves on how often they'll jump up, what are the behaviours they're seeing. And the reason why we get them to do this is because just because, you know, when we're looking at feedback, it might be my child still can't sit when they're doing homework or they still can't sit during a meal, but it might be that before they were getting up five times during the meal and now they're only getting up once. So we, you know, we want to explain to parents that the issues might be, the changes might be quite subtle, but they've got to let us know those subtleties of change so that we know where they're on the right track in terms of training. So the monitoring might be video monitoring. Sometimes it's really helpful. I find parents actually forget quite a bit what their children were like before. And of course, adults will also forget what they're like before. Even myself, I trained my own daughter, and I had completely forgotten what she'd what she was like until it was, I think, school holidays. It was a few years ago that I trained her now. And we went into the 6-week school holidays and I just didn't bring her back to neurofeedback. And by the end, she'd reverted. And I had completely forgotten some of the symptoms that she had. And I think it was from there that I started to realize that you really do need to start to write these down and each time review them before you actually give feedback so that you can compare the changes in neurofeedback, not just compared to the prior session, but also compared to pre-neurofeedback training. So in our forms, we have a comparison of not just compared to the last session, is this better than the last session, but is this better overall compared to pre-neurofeedback training? So it might be worse than the last session, but overall still better, and then you can sort of make judgments about protocols. Then there's when to stop if it's not working. Now, obviously, there are a certain percentage of people who neurofeedback does not work for. So I normally say to parents or adults, 15 sessions, that's my sort of go-to. It might be that we train longer at some point. There might be a reason why we're not seeing great changes. So, for example, for people who are both under and over aroused and we're doing multiple protocols, we might find that it's just really tricky to get the balance right. So in which case, if they're showing some sort of benefits, I'll go beyond the 15 sessions. But if we're at 15 sessions and there's absolutely nothing happening, you know, no changes, then I'll terminate. I might terminate before as well. But just so they know that concept, that we don't just keep on training indefinitely, that there will come a point where we're going to meet up again. And at that point, then we can determine whether or not it's worthwhile continuing. So last one is what happens when they finish, the follow-up assessment and potentially other treatments. And I should say that it's not that I wait until neurofeedback until I introduce other treatments. Many of our kids will be getting both psychological therapy and neurofeedback at the same time. Most of the time, though, I wait for cognitive training. I won't necessarily do cognitive training until we finish the neurofeedback, and I'll use cognitive training just to, say, tighten up some executive skills or whatever it happens to be. Speech therapy, a lot of them will also go to speech therapy or visual training at the same time as neurofeedback. And behavioural management, obviously, you know, a lot of parents, you know, they're there. Be tearing the hair out over kids' behaviour, and I'll usually say to them, look, if you're going to try neurofeedback, let's give it, you know, 4 or 5 sessions, and if then at that stage you're not seeing something that, you know, moving in the right direction, we can get stuck into some behaviour management at home. And if there's parenting issues, full stop, I might, you know, like certain practices which I don't think are good ideas, then I might get stuck straight into parenting before I even get onto neurofeedback. So just to finish up, there's 2 important things which I think, you know, a lot of patients will obviously ask about the research evidence. I put them onto a website called neurofeedbackalliance.org. It's a very updated website which has a summary of pretty much every type of area and summaries, just very brief, 1 or 2 lines on every paper that's ever been produced with positive outcomes in neurofeedback. I find that's a really good resource to put them onto, that I can just say to them, look, there is good research evidence for, whatever it happens to be that there is good research evidence for, and they can go look at this website. I have a glossy brochure with that website on the back of it, which I hand to them, which they can look at their own leisure. The other thing, though, is obviously, we do train people where there isn't a good research evidence. And in these cases, which is what I call experimental neurofeedback, a lot of people will come to me for a variety of different types of conditions where we don't have a good evidence base. And in these cases, I basically say to them, look, we've had good success in the past with whatever this condition is, or maybe we've had no experience in this condition, but we can do a brain scan, we can train, it's completely experimental, we don't know whether or not it's going to work, but you can give it a go and you've got nothing to lose. And these are obviously in patients where there's very little other options. So, for example, I had someone who came across, who I met with this week, who was a four-year-old, had already developed Tourette's. I've never seen Tourette's in such a young kid, had anxiety, had significant attention issues, so will probably be diagnosed with ADHD, pretty severe language deficits, and I think, according to what the parents were saying, there's several episodes per day where the kid stares off into space and is completely non-responsive, so it sounds like he's also having absent seizures. So these are the complex cases that do come across my desk. Obviously, we're going to send the kid to a neurologist and find out about the absent seizures and, probably obviously he's got, epilepsy to go on medication. But at some point, this is the sort of kid who is probably not going to be able to take a stimulant in terms of their attention skills, and is someone who we're going to want to do training with neurofeedback, and it's going to be completely experimental because they actually came to me for Tourette's. Do I know any evidence that, neurofeedback is helpful for someone who's 4 years old with Tourette's? I don't know of any research evidence of that. We do treat Tourette's here, and everyone who we treat, whether it's chronic motor tic disorder or Tourette's, I say to them, this is completely experimental. We have really good, success with these people. But, does it have the research? No. If they've tried medication, what have they got to lose? And this is, what we see a lot of people who come to us, and they might have intellectual disability, and they'll say, we want to try NF. And I'll say, of course, there is no research evidence for it, but if I had a kid with an intellectual disability, I'd want to be trying it. I'd want to be seeing what it can achieve. And it's just explaining, giving really good informed consent that this is an experimental procedure. And there is no scientific evidence for it, but, we will go for a certain number of sessions, and if we see improvements, we will continue, and if we don't see improvements, we won't. And I'll talk anecdotally about some of the experience that we've had with people with intellectual disabilities, which surprisingly has been very interesting and very effective in terms of increasing IQ. I can't explain how we achieve that, and I don't try and explain it. All I say is that if there's something that we can see on a QEG and something that we can train, why not? But I think, being able to go through expectations and not putting people's hopes up too high, and talking about success rates is really important, just so that you don't get yourself stuck into, problems with people saying, oh, this didn't work and I want my money back. Obviously, like all types of therapy, there are certain types of success rates, whether that's CBT, whether that's medication, and it's having them understand that, neurofeedback sits alongside of that. It's not a miracle cure for things, but can have amazing effects, in terms of lots of different aspects, whether it's brain functioning, cognitive ability, emotion, behaviour, mood, all those sorts of things. So that's pretty much all I had to say about that topic. If anyone has any questions.
Thank you so much, Shelley. That was fabulous. I love all your graphics. Are you the creative one, or do you outsource that work?
No, that's what I do for fun.
Yeah, that's lovely. Well done. Great content, great presentation. Any questions? We've got a couple of minutes before we'll be hearing from Kerry and how she monitors change in neurofeedback. I'll just take that screen back from you. Any questions for Shelley?
Shelley, can I ask, do you use ERPs at all?
At the moment, I'm not using ERPs just because I haven't been able to get the software working.